Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning I thought what I'd like to do is, there's an interesting story of Bodhidharma. I think you all, most of you at least, I'm sure, have heard this one. Bodhidharma, by the way, for those of you who might not know, was the Brahmin, the Zen patriarch who brought Zen from India to China in the 5th century of the current era. And a lot of interesting stories about him. First patriarch of Zen in China, basically the founder of the Zen school. And there's one story of Bodhidharma as he gathered his disciples together. He only had four students who were really close to him. And he brought them together to see what they understood. So he said, you know, give me your understanding. And the first one said that truth neither adheres to words nor is apart from them. And Bodhidharma says, you have my skin. And the second one said, the truth once glimpsed is never seen again. And he said, you have my flesh. And the third one said that phenomena, all phenomena and the skandhas, the five skandhas are empty. There's no truth to be grasped. And he said, you have my bones. And finally, the fourth student, this was Wiko, who was in our lineage, he just stood there. And then he bowed. And Bodhidharma said, you have my marrow. So these are the Bodhidharma's four students. You may have heard this story before. It's very common in Zen. There's a lot of things that spin off from this, which maybe we can look at a little bit today. Let's just take a look at these one by one. This first student, this says that truth neither adheres to words nor is apart from them. And Bodhidharma accepted this, but it was kind of a shallow. He said, "This, you have my skin." This is sort of a shallow understanding, perhaps, but pretty good. Pretty good if you notice that the truth doesn't adhere to words and letters. You know, what is spoken or written down, we can't say what the truth is. We can't write it down. But so often, you know, we think that we can. Just in our ordinary everyday thinking, we're thinking we're doing this all the time. We're adhering to truth through what we say, through what we think, how we act, what we believe. To notice that actually, you know, we don't really touch the truth this way. We don't, you know, these words don't really stick to the truth. They don't really point out the truth. They don't really, well, maybe they can point to the truth, but they certainly can't be the truth. On the other hand, he said, and this is very good, very Zen, he said, but neither are they apart from truth. Because we can never really step outside of truth. We can never be apart from the truth. And, of course, with any kind of teaching, well, maybe not any kind of teaching, but much of the teaching that we receive, it's done through words. So somehow words can be employed in this way of seeking for truth. But on the other hand, if we hold on to those words, we never have it. Well, Bodhidharma acknowledged that. It's pretty good. It's kind of thin, but pretty good. So he acknowledged that. And the next one, maybe you're going to try a little harder, you know. Get a little deeper under Bodhidharma's skin. So he said that the truth, once glimpsed, is never seen again. It's not to be seen again. Well, what on earth does that mean? I mean, does that mean like that's all we get? We get one shot, one little glimpse, and we're cut off again from the truth? Well, not exactly. Is it that truth is something that you see it, once you see it, we're talking about actual truth, not an idea that you might have of truth, but actually seeing how things are, which isn't really anything in particular. But once this is seen, we don't see it again. It isn't like somehow now we lose that. We forget about it. Well, maybe we forget about it. But it isn't like it's lost to us. we now see how it is, and we're not going to be so easily fooled now. It's very much like that tall picture that I use for those of you who are familiar with my tall picture. For those of you who aren't, it's just a bunch of, at first it probably looks like just a bunch of black splotches on a page. But at some point you see it's a cow. Once you see it's a cow, you can't not see it's a cow. So it's kind of like that. Once seen, you don't see it again. That seeing it, original seeing of it, first seeing of it, this doesn't occur again. So it's also not like something, a regular truth or a regular phenomenon or something of this sort, where we might get some sense of something, get an idea. You have truth, holding truth, this is a small t truth. You get some kind of idea of truth, get some little glimpse of that, and then we lose it. And we're, just what was that again? And maybe we can't get it back. But the truth isn't like this. Actual truth, reality, isn't like this. Once seen, you might momentarily not pay attention or forget about, but the moment you bring your mind back to it, it, that has been seen, and it doesn't come to us again. It doesn't need to. Once we understand how it is, we don't lose track of that. Like learning a bicycle, maybe, except far more profound, I would say. But that's what the second student is pointing out. And Bodhidharma says, "You have my flesh. You've gone a little deeper here." Then he looks at the third student, and the third student says that all phenomena are empty. And the five skandhas, for those of you who might not know this, if we look at a human being, what is a human being? We kind of analyze just what we have here as a human being. We can break this human being down into all of its constituent parts. You know, we call these dharmas. You know, they're not actual parts as such, but all kinds of elements of both body and mind. And these are the five. And then they can be reassembled in these different groups called the skandhas. Yeah. So there's one group for the body, and then there's four mental skandhas that are what? There's sensation, conception, inclinations, and perception, and but different elements, different parts to these different skandhas. Well, here the third student says that all phenomena and the five skandhas, all the elements that go into making up a human being, human existence, they're empty. And he said no truth, no dharma can be grasped. Well, what's he saying now? He's just looking at this a little bit more deeply, that the all of this stuff that's out there that seems so real to us, the different elements of our experience and all of phenomena, whatever we have here, if we go in and look very carefully, whenever we think we've got hold of something here, some idea, some thought, some emotion, you know, you're very close to your emotions, you know, you really feel something deeply. But what is it exactly that's being felt here? And notice how in each fleeting instant, it's never the same. It keeps shifting, changing. It's because it's empty. We don't actually have a particular thing here. We never do. This is what the third student is observing, that all phenomena are empty. And so there's no truth that can be grasped, because the truths that we grasp, the ideas that we have, the concepts we have, the beliefs we have, the notions we have about this or that, one thing or another, these are all things that we can, that we grasp, that we take hold of. They seem to have size and shape and relationships and limits and all of this, boundaries, you know. These are things that we can grasp. Both physically and mentally, as ideas and notions, and but all of these things that we—this is just a phenomena, which is empty. or these different constituent elements of human existence. Every time we try to grasp one, we find it all just sort of trickling out between our fingers. Can't really take hold of this. Upon very careful observation of actual experience, this is what we find. This is the truth. This is the reality. But any kind of truth or reality that we think we can grasp is empty. We don't find anything there. So he said, no Dharma, no truth can be. And this really saves us from arrogance, from somehow thinking that I've got the right idea here. This is how it is. My truth is better than yours. All of this kind of nonsense and thinking that we as human beings get caught up in. Start arguing over and fighting over and carrying on, threatening ourselves all over the globe with such nonsense. Upon very honest and careful observation of our experience, we realize that this is all empty, nothing here to be grasped. That it doesn't mean that it is nothing, however, as if nothing is going on here. Quite obviously, something's going on here. But it is never something that we can grasp and take hold of and become so arrogant as to thinking somehow we've got our hands on the truth here. So no truth, no Dharma can be grasped as such. He doesn't say this at this point, but it just doesn't mean that truth or reality cannot be seen or known or understood, however. And so here we go to the fourth student, as we call. Some of you will be a little bit more famous than the other three. And what about you? And Wiko says nothing. But then he bows. And Bodhidharma says, you have my marrow. That Wiko isn't. We get to this place where nothing to be grasped. Also nothing to be said. Because whatever we would say, and we should know this, that whatever we would say isn't really the truth. That we cannot say it. So we call, he's not talking to Bodhidharma. He realizes at this point, nothing to say. Well, here we have these four students. So very often in Zen, Zen students are kind of likened to these four. And there's other kinds of references. In fact, I suspect that this very reference, I think it's apocryphal, Bodhidharma called these four guys in and asked them what they thought. And it makes a very good a story, and there's a lot of teaching in it. But whether or not that actually unfolded in that way, I don't know. Perhaps a cynic would say, you know, I bet you Hui Ko, the only guy who actually had a lineage that, you know, followed from him, I bet you he was really the first guy. And but he's the one that survived it, so he said, you know, I was really the fourth guy. I mean, we can start making up all kinds of stories about this, you know. But that doesn't really matter. These teachings are, we shouldn't grasp them as though somehow these teachings themselves are truth, reality, and this really happened and it was unfolded just like this and all of that. No, there's something here that these teachings point to. We should always bear that in mind. But I think that this story itself perhaps could have been formed out of an earlier story that we find in some of the sutras of there's four kinds of horses. You know this one? Suzuki Roshi alludes to this in his Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. The four, you know, very often the Zen students are likened to these four kinds of horses, you know. And you have the worst kind of horse, the worst horse. This is the horse who won't run, won't turn right or left or run or stop or gallop or whatever, unless you just really just whip him and whip him and whip him, just, you know, just beat him until he finally starts to obey and begins to gallop. Have you ever known a horse like that? But this very often Zen students are you know, likened to these four horses. We have that poor student Suzuki. He speaks of it like this, where the poor student, you know, they just really have a hard time with this practice, and you have to really, you know, hit them over the head. A lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of difficulty. You know, not wanting to come to the practice and all of that. And I was kind of a horse like that in a way, at least in terms of having a lot of pain and difficulty with this practice. It was very difficult for me to do at the beginning. But I did it. So I don't know what kind of horse I was. So I shouldn't drag myself in here. But that third horse, the third horse is the one who will begin to move, respond, to the driver, to the whip. As soon as they feel that snap of the whip on their skin, this is the next best Zen student. So they don't really have to clobber them over there. You give them a little snap there, and they feel it, and then they begin to move, and they begin to practice and to engage in this way. But a better horse still, though, is this one where even at just the sound of the whip, just the sound of the snap of the whip, they are fully engaged, ready to run, to gallop, to turn right or left, to engage this practice completely and totally. But the best student is the one where even at the shadow of the whip, it is said, the best horse runs at the shadow of the whip. So no, you don't even have to feel that pain at all. But then Suzuki, when he talks about this, he points out how the best Zen students, these ones, they just sit there, they don't move, and they'll sit all day long. They'll do a 7-day session, and they'll sit all night, all the way through the night on the last day until the sun rises the next morning, just sitting there. This is your best Zen student with no pain. I used to envy people like this, but Suzuki pointed out how this best horse, though, this one that can sit, if you can sit that way with no pain, he says very often these people are very slow to actually wake up, to find the truth, that if we struggle with this a little bit, we have some difficulty with it. It's kind of grist for the mill, I guess, something to work against. So we should, take that to heart a little bit. But actually, if we look at these four ways of looking at a Zen student, and there's other ways too, by the way. Maybe I'll give you another one. Actually, this is what I was thinking about, what got me thinking about this in the first place. Is on Wednesday nights we're studying, in our study group we're looking at the instructions to the cook, the Tenzo Kyokan of Dogen. Very profound teaching there. And at the end, which is where we're nearing now, he talks of Roshin, parental mind. And we were talking a little bit about the mind of a parent, what is that exactly? And how a parent would do anything without a thought for the child, just immediately jump to. Well, if we look at this more carefully, though, and also if we look just carefully at what this term Roshin means, it's probably even more like grandparental mind, because perhaps parent can still have a sort of attachment there, ambitions for the child that make it a little difficult for the parent to really care for the child in a truly unselfish way. And so there might be some difficulty there with Roshin, with this parental mind that Dogen speaks of. It is really a mind of, it's kind of a dispassionate mind, but of really taking care of this child. And he talked earlier in the Tenzo Kyokan, he talks about handling the objects, the utensils and things, because he's talking about the cook, but handling all of these tools and things, these instruments and pots and pans and whatever, as if they were your own eyes, he said, as if they were. But this would be the care with which we would approach everything. So it's like everything then would be the child in terms of how you would take care of these things. You would take care of these things in the most loving and tender way, understanding what these objects and what these things are. And this is a kind of mind that we would cultivate in Zen, in Zen practice. A mind that is tending to everything that comes into our, you know, into our sphere, into our, under our influence here. That we take care of all of these things and handle them as though they were our own eyes. This would be taken care, like with parental mind. Well, so there's real subtlety to this. So that we, and it's so easy to miss this kind of subtlety that is within this teaching. It's very soft, very gentle. We talk of parental mind, some things, and we say, oh, yeah, parent. And of course, we might associate with feelings that we might have with our own parents, or if we are parents, with our experience as being a parent, and all that. And it very quickly gets into kind of a narrow box here, and it also becomes objectified and set out there. Well, I was thinking about all of this, and because I know this teaching to be something very, very profound, very quiet, very still, and not easily absorbed, not easily digested. And I also know that we as human beings, we're very obtuse, and we're very quick to conceptualize our experience and to conceptualize the teaching and to set it off over there and apart from ourselves. And then also even to apply it to ourselves in various ways. Such as, say, we have these teachings of the four horses or the four kinds of students that Bodhidharma had, etc. We're very quick to objectify it and set it out there like that. And then we put ourselves in there and we wonder, no, how am I doing? What kind of a horse am I? You know, what kind of a Zen student am I? If I were a disciple of Bodhidharma, what would I, where would I fit in all of this? So we're very quick to do something like this. But then we don't, when we do that, we don't really give ourselves a chance to absorb this teaching and to, you know, just to soak in it and to see just what it is. So I was thinking, well, you know, there's four ways. There's four ways that we can approach the teaching. So just to go right back to using that gimmick, yeah. Four ways. We look at a teaching like Roshin, like parental mind. And there are students who, when we hear these soft, gentle teachings, they just kind of waft past, you know, and maybe we think, oh, well, that's really nice. That's a nice, it's nice teaching, you know, and nice practice, you know. And we go on about our daily life, and nothing's happened. And we come back. And there's some other nice teachings, nice images. And then we leave and nothing happens. And we come back and we, you know, stick our toe in the water again and it's nice. It's really nice. And nothing happens. In other words, we can hear these teachings. We might even have a sense of the subtlety within this. But it doesn't seem to occur to us that we're talking about our life here. We're talking about reality. We're talking about life as it's being lived in each moment. It's not out there on the page or in the story. I mean, these are just things to draw our attention to what? To this right here, this reality right here. And, you know, it's so easy for us to miss that. But that's a kind of a horse. That's a kind of a person like that. And sometimes we can drift along for a long time before we realize that this teaching actually has some real bite to it, and that there's something there that needs to be taken up and digested and worked through. But at some point too, we might take it up. We realize, yeah, you know, boy, there are people like this. And there's another kind of horse where we're looking at how other people are doing and how they're taking up the practice and thinking that somehow these teachings apply to other people, that they don't really apply to us, or that we think, I've already got it. Yeah, I understand the Roshin, or I understand these four kinds of horses. we get an idea of it, we have it fixed, and now we think that we've got it. We put ourselves in the picture, and we think we have it, and then maybe we're thinking that somehow, as these teachings come drifting by from time to time, because we bring ourselves into the vicinity where these teachings are being spoken and used, that it doesn't really apply to us. So once again, we don't really take this to heart, either because we already have it or because it belongs to someone else. But there's this other horse who does hear this teaching, and who does reflect on the, you know, this horse does reflect on their self, and how they are, and how they're practicing, and how they're listening, and how they're taking this up. And so they make this effort. They make that second horse too. By the way, they might take it up for a degree. And then they think they got it, or they just kind of set it down again and start looking around. But this third horse, they'll take it up. They'll take it up as soon as they hear something. They hear this teaching of Roshin, and treating all things as though they were your eyes. Now just being very, very careful, very mindful with everything. So suddenly you see a shift in this person's behavior, a shift in their attitude. Their approach to this practice. But the problem with this kind of understanding is that you're still seeing yourself sitting here, and you're seeing this teaching being applied to the outside. And it's like something almost that's being imposed upon you, something you're trying to force yourself to change to. So you would outwardly, deliberately try to change your behavior, because you think a Zen student should be like this, or a Zen student should be like that. But I would say that there's this fourth way. Actually, I really wouldn't say that there's a fourth way, but since I'm talking like this, I'll say there's a fourth way. And this fourth way of listening to this teaching, of taking it to heart, is where perhaps outwardly you make no shift at all. And I would say, if we're going to talk about the worst horse, second best, here's your best horse. Your best horse. That you do not take, because that's an ordinary kind of teaching that you would take up like that and apply it to yourself and have it fix you up in some way, straighten you out. Something you'd put on like a badge, or like some kind of identity or a label. And that's not what this teaching is. No, this teaching is you go right ahead and practice as you have been, living your life as you have been. But because with a deeper understanding of this teaching, where is the application? Where is this? What is this speaking to? What is it that we need to first be looking at? And it is how we are living our life. We look at our mind. We look at our attitude. We look at our approach. We look at how this all manifests in our behavior. We just start to see that. And it is in this way that rather than being told, well, you should be like this, you should behave like this, you should do the practice like this, in very superficial ways this might work, but when it comes down to a deeper understanding of what is going on here, none of this can be applied from the outside. This has to be taken in completely, deeply. And I would say to continue on practicing and living in the way that you do, but now you are starting to watch that. You observe this. You, like when we study something like Roshin, we look at the subtleties with which Dogen is speaking. Now, it doesn't mean now that suddenly we take up the broom and we sweep very carefully like we never did before. Now, I would say pick up the broom and sweep the way you always did, but now you're noticing how it is that you're handling that broom. This is Zen practice. This is how we take it up. This is how we apply it. So it isn't something from the outside that we try to bend and conform ourselves to, but that we actually look at it from the inside out. And we're seeing how it is that we actually take it up. Never mind how it manifests on the outside. Because when you finally see this for what it is, how it is that you're engaging this practice, how it is you're engaging this teaching and taking it up, that outward manifestation will take care of itself. This applies to whether or not we shave our head or put on robes or any of these other kinds of things that we might want to slap on ourselves, or even a certain kind of behavior, a certain way that we carry ourselves, you know, as a Zen student. Never mind all of that. Because this is still to treat this teaching, this profound teaching, this subtle teaching, as though it were something cheap, as though it were something you can use, something you can slap on yourself to make you a better person, or maybe a, you know, turn yourself into some kind of a Zen hot dog or something like this, so you can impress other people with it, or whatever. Just a lot of thinking there, a lot of ego there. So these first ways, you know, where we don't hear the teaching, or we hear it but we resist it, or we hear it and we try to take it up, all of this is way too much. Just very quietly, never mind what's occurring on the outside. You look, you understand, you digest this teaching, and now look at how you are living. Look at how you are conducting your life. No one else needs to know. Most other people won't know. But by and by, maybe people will notice something later on, gradually, slowly. But there shouldn't be any overt things. This is too is what I mean by with this practice. We don't need to strain, struggle, force ourselves into becoming something other than what we are. Now, this is a way to really get in there and to look at the true way that you actually express yourself, and to see that, to learn that, and to express it fully and completely. Because when you do that, you can only do that by seeing yourself as a part of all of this. In fact, actually seeing yourself as all beings and practicing with all beings. All of that outward stuff falls into line, takes care of itself. You don't need to be concerned with image or application or anything of this sort. So this is kind of the best horse. Oh, and then finally, the last thing I want to say, that these kinds of teachings too about worst horse, best horse, all that kind of thing. I guess I already kind of mentioned this. Be very careful with that. You know, it's nice. You know, we have these teachings like Bodhidharma is for students, you know, because they're easy to listen to. But they're also easy to pick up in the wrong way. And how am I doing? You know, we have the 8 ox herding picture. Now you wonder, now where am I? Which ox picture am I on? We do this sort of thing all the time. The 10 stages of a bodhisattva's development. Or what stage am I at now? You know. And these teachings serve a purpose. They're helpful. But are there really 4 kinds of instances? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know how many, you know, there's no end to how many kinds of Zen students there are. And what kind are you? Don't worry about what kind you are. It's not your business. You know, but we can point out, we can use these teachings to kind of point out some of these things. But you're not nailed down. You never have been, and you never will be. And even though you nail yourself down in your mind, or somebody else has you pegged and wriggling against the wall, that's just all stuff going on in people's minds. It has nothing to do with reality. And this teaching, this practice is about learning to see what's real, what's true, what's going on there. And this is what we apply our minds to. This is what we look at. And as for one of these 4, even if there were these 4, you know, you don't stay there. If you're this, you're one of these, you're one of those, you know. You don't stay there. Nothing is staying put. well, I don't know. So when we talk about something like Roshin or any of these teachings, take it, you know, look at how you're living. Look at how you're sweeping the floor. Now, this is the way we apply this teaching. Any questions or comments? One of the reasons, too, that unless you have a question, that we don't take the teaching in this way is because if you notice what I just pointed out, you're not left with anything that as you defined. And we don't like that. We want ourselves defined. We want to clarify that. But this is our ego talking. This is our ego back in the driver's seat here. And of course, we always want it defined pretty well, you know, so that we look pretty good. But sometimes we realize that, you know, in this situation here, I'm really not so good. But again, it's always putting everything into a crystalline form. But if we understand this teaching, and if I got it across what I was talking about today, just how fluid this all is, where we don't take the time to define ourselves, to pin ourselves down, to say how we're doing. We don't take the time for that because you can't do it. Sure, you can come up with an answer. How am I doing? Now you got an answer. You know, you're scored about 63 there. Well, yeah, but 63 what? You know, we think that somehow we've labeled something, we've calibrated something here, but you haven't. You haven't. And when it comes down to what is actually taking place here, you can't do that. And so this teaching, once again, is very, very subtle. But if we can learn to approach it in that way, and not take this up, but somehow having some kind of notion about ourselves, how we're doing, or how I want to improve myself for this, through this teaching, then we can actually realize just what we have here. And we can know freedom. Because this teaching in the end is about freedom. Freedom of mind. Not being taken in, not being duped, not being cowed into submission or fear or whatever. Any questions?
Okay, I have a question.
Oh, okay.
You refer to this teaching as soft and gentle.
Mm-hmm.
That's news to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's also, that's the whole thing, too. Other times I might talk about this teaching as being tough. And in fact, I was just talking with someone this morning about how tough, say, this Nagarjuna study is, you know. And, because this teaching in the end, you know, how is it? Is it soft and gentle? No, you really can't say. Again, that's the thing. That when words are used, particularly in a dharma and teaching, these words, normally when a word is kind of lobbed out there, and we think we've got something solid, and we've got something, but we never have. We never have. So the words are used not to give us something to grasp, but basically, again, this is what I was really talking about here, to notice what you're doing in this moment, to realize what you're doing. And there is a kind of a gentleness to it. Yeah. So that's there. But then there's kind of a toughness to it, too. But the toughness, the difficulty, is only there when we put ourselves there. If you're not there, there's nothing hard about it. There's nothing tough. You know? But every time we get in there and I want to get something from this, I want to figure this out, I want to understand this, I want to grasp, I want to be enlightened, when we insert these kinds of things in here, now we've got some difficulty. We have a hard time with it. We struggle with it. And I remember early in my days of practice, I used to do that. struggle with it. I thought, you know, I have to do it. I want to get something. I wanted to get somewhere, and I didn't feel like I was going to get anywhere else. And I was kind of discouraged that, you know, Zen was so hard, you know, especially doing sesshins. My gosh, oh, you know. But at some point, I realized what I was doing. I was creating that whole picture. But Zen itself wasn't that way. So I say it's really kind of gentle. But is it really gentle? Well, I don't know. Yeah. Depends on you, I guess. Because it really isn't any way in particular. But then nor are you. And so we can change. I changed. My attitude changed. And then all of a sudden it's, you know, so Zen, is it hard or easy? You know, we talked about this last couple of sessions because of the dawn at Hokyoji. You do a 7-day session, you know, particularly at the beginning. Oh, boy, this is going to be tough. This is going to be hard, you know. But is it? Now you're nearing the end of that session, kind of cruising along there on the cushion, you know. And is it hard? I don't know. And you're all done. Wow, you know. So, you know, what is it really? Yeah, well, this all depends on us. It's our own attitude, our own mind. But that's the part that we're not paying any attention to, because we think all that stuff out there is so real and graspable and can be manipulated. So once again, what I was, in a nutshell, what I was trying to, just in another way, just to point out, take this to heart. And you know, when you hear this teaching, you look at it, and now don't try to grasp that, but in conjunction with that now, just see how you're living. And like I said, don't try to apply this now to change you. Just start noticing what you're doing. Because there isn't any, because whatever you're going to take here to apply, this is your thinking. That's just your idea. This is just mental construction. It's just, you know, this opens us up a little bit. Now take a look. Because here's where the reality is, and how you're actually carrying on from moment to moment. That's the hardest thing as a Zen student, to learn that, to realize that. But that's where it takes place. And it doesn't come to the application. It doesn't come to the teaching in the ordinary way. We don't take up this teaching in the ordinary way. But of course, we only know the ordinary way, so we keep doing that for the longest time. But at some point, we have to realize what we're doing now. And everything about this teaching is to draw our attention one way or to another, and all the subtle different aspects of it. What's happening now? What is your stance, your approach, your attitude, your inclination of mind, all of this that we generally pay no attention to? But this is where we wake up. And if we are interested in awakening, this is where we need to learn to look. And you will do that. I can't do it for you. Buddha can't do it for you. The book isn't going to do it for you. Even the practice. Yeah, you sit a lot of the Zen. It isn't going to do it for you. You know, you have to just do it. You have to look at what you're doing now. And that's what this teaching is always pointing to. It's just pointing to right this immediate moment. One way or another, in countless different ways. But that's the last place we bring ourselves to. Did I answer your question, Scott? I rambled on some more there, but yes.
Well, if you are doing that, you're looking at what you're doing, and you see that you're putting yourself in the picture. And you think, all right, this is causing pain and suffering. Well, you've often talked about how whatever is causing the pain and suffering will naturally drop away.
Mm-hmm.
There's no conscious decision to change behavior.
Well, there might be. But and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if you see in some gross way you're really doing something that's not particularly healthy, and you can now stop, then go ahead. you consciously, yeah, you can stop that. But if you think that somehow you're going to consciously drive it all the way into enlightenment, you're not going to do that. And that's what I mean. But if along the way you suddenly you wake up to, you know, the nasty things you constantly say to your neighbor, you know, or something like that. I'm just trying to make something up here. But you could make a conscious decision to, you know, lay off of that when you start to notice that maybe this isn't really the best way to maintain a relationship. You know, that sort of thing. So, I mean, yeah, you can do that. You know, and perhaps we should do that. But what I'm saying is that's kind of gross stuff. And but we need to take care of that when you notice that. But if somehow you think that you can consciously, you know, bring yourself into conducting yourself awake in this moment, you can't do that. So don't even try. No, instead make the effort to just be here. Realize what you're doing. You know, but the moment you string it out and, well, I am doing this and this isn't good and I should be doing it, you know, suddenly, you know, right back to our ordinary mind. And you're you know, and you're lost. Now, this is why enlightenment is called that golden fish that swims up to you. You can't go after it as such. But you can make yourself ready. And that is, how do you do that? Well, by start paying attention. See what you're doing. And to the extent that you start to see that this behavior, that behavior isn't particularly helpful, is hurtful in some way, it will of its own drop away. But it has to really be seen. And I'm talking about seeing it not in these gross ways. I'm talking about seeing it in a very refined way. And when enough of that happens, we're no longer fooled. But sure, at any given moment, you see yourself doing something that isn't particularly good or wholesome or healthy or helpful, and you can make an effort to stop. But yes, why don't you stop it? Say if you were a smoker, you know, sometimes people say, well, should I smoke? Well, no, you probably shouldn't smoke, you know. And, you know, I mean, we all know it's not healthy, you know. Well, and of course, intellectually we know that, you know. But at some point, you know, we're talking about, you get into a point where you really know that. And you really see that, you won't smoke. But it has to get to that point, see. All along, you've known all along. Maybe you started as a teenager, and you were even told as a teenager, you know, that's not good. But of course, you're going to defy mom and dad and whoever, you know. And see, you know, but now you're an addict. You're hooked. You see, and so it's very hard, you know. But you know all along. You see, intellectually, yeah, you know, but you really don't know. Because when you really know, you wouldn't do it. And awakening is just like that. You know, but you don't get there by deliberately bringing you to this place, you know, because you don't know what it is. You don't know what reality is. You don't know what enlightenment is. You don't know where is the spot. You can't find it. Nobody can. Nobody knows. I mean, it's not something to be known in that way. But what is known, what, you know, is all we're off. You know, this isn't it. This isn't it. Isn't it? And we can bring this to a very refined point of, you know, of observation and knowing and understanding. Yeah, but the deliberate stuff doesn't no longer gonna operate in there. You know, that's well on the gross level. But nevertheless, employ it when you can. Sure, why not? Anything else? Yes.
The teacher's approach different
from each of
the students?
Oh, yes, yeah. Is the teacher's approach different? Yeah, sure. Everybody's different. Mm-hmm.
So the four horses are a million horses.
Yeah, so there's a million different ways. Yeah. And there's no right way. There's no particular right way. Yeah. Anything else? Actually, there's no way. Okay, well, thank you very much.